of cream, red roses too. I see them blue.
This is Ed Cohen, editor of GlobalBusinessNews.net, and your host today on GlobalRadioTalkShow.com. Coming to you today from Salt Lake City, Utah, and San Diego, California. Our special guests today, leadership experts Robert Anderson and William Adams, chairman and CEO, respectively, of the Leadership Circle and the Full Circle Group. Let's welcome Bob Anderson and Bill Adams. Hi, guys.
Hey. Hey. Thanks for having us.
You bet. So there's a lot of leadership books out there. Quick fixes, people who set themselves up as the answer man. So what's your approach, and why did you write Mastering Leadership, an Integrated Framework for Breakthrough Performance and Extraordinary Business Results? What's Mastering Leadership all about?
This is Bill, and I've been in the work for about 30 years on development of leaders and what it means for that to impact business performance. And met Bob about 12 years ago, and we've done a lot of integration on our work, and I keyed right in on what you asked right off the bat and mentioned, which it's not a quick fix approach. Over those years, learned that in order for leaders to develop, if they choose to develop and grow, they need to make it part of what they do on a day-to-day basis, and we think about it as development for a lifetime. Those that work with us and for us have an expectation we're going to be more effective next year than we are this year. And in order for us to do that as leaders, we need to take on our own growth and development, and it has bottom line impact when we do that. So it's anything but a quick fix, but you can get results. You start working on it, paying attention to it. And that's really for us why we wrote the book.
Bob, you're the creator of Leadership Circle Profile. And what's the Leadership Circle?
Well, it's in the genre of a 360 assessment, but it's much more than that. It does measure a whole array of the kind of key competencies that we know from decades of research on competencies, what works, what makes leaders more effective, how they need to lead. Most assessments, however, do not get underneath the pattern in the results and say, well, what's going on more reactively that ways you default to less effective behaviors that might be interrupting your leadership. And so the Leadership Circle Profile is the only 360 out there that is based on a universal model of leadership. I spent most of my career trying to integrate the disparate, fragmented field of leadership into a very coherent, extensive framework and built an assessment out of it. So it's the only one that has an underlying model. It's the only one that measures both consciousness, how you think in the moment, and behavior, competency, how you show up. So it's a very quick window into the underlying thinking and operating system that's running your leadership.
I would like to jump into the book here a little bit. Chapter 9, Leadership at Work, From Patriarchy to Partnership. Who wants to tackle that?
Oh, my guess is that we both got a little bit to say about that, Ed. The primary or predominant model that we have inside organizations operating is a patriarchy model, which is in some ways the top-down, which we don't at all suggest is not important. In fact, just the opposite. Most organizations are a hierarchical model. It's when that patriarch side, which is, I know better than you, I have all the answers, I'm able actually to control, and if we'll only follow and do what it is I say, then the organization is going to be effective, has such significant limitations in it when it comes to engaging an organization and being able to get the potential that exists in that organization, bring it to surface and capitalize on it. A partnership model, on the other hand, says, hey, we're going to get the very, very, very best out of the people that are here, not just a cliche, they're our greatest resources. How can we tap into that energy, and what does it take to actually engage people so that they can bring forth their leadership and their discretionary energy and contribute it to what it is we're trying to accomplish together? The patriarchy model has a very difficult time making that happen.
How do you attach that amount of thinking that body of thinking towards startups. Is that possible?
Sure. This is one of our real passion places. What we find consistently in startups, we do a lot of work, is that once you get into a startup situation, very early on, one of the first things that happens is that the strength of leadership starts to surface. In other words, do I have a strong leader, or do I have an entrepreneur that doesn't have the strong kind of capability of leadership, but a great idea and is good at executing that? And as the startup starts to grow, the need for more leadership and more effective leadership becomes present. So when we walk into a startup, we find the need for and the importance of effective leadership is probably more important than any other setting we're in. And no question, if a leader will start to get that early on as the organization starts to grow and develop, then they're going to be more effective as their organization.
So emotional intelligence comes into it. Your chapter 5 is about structures of mind and performance. Is that a psychological study?
It comes out of psychology. In other words, there's a whole body of research on stages of adult development. We call them stages of leadership. And it's just now finding its way into the leadership field. When I came across it in the mid-90s, it was the biggest framework I'd come across for helping us understand what makes for effective leadership and how it develops. So in a nutshell, it's the research suggests that as we evolve, if we evolve and develop our inner game, it goes through very discrete stages, like an operating system, DOS to Windows 7, and Windows 10, you know, goes through very discrete, measurable stages. And with each stage comes more capability and capacity to meet complexity with greater mastery, agility, you know, innovativeness, and so on. All the stuff we're looking for actually emerges on a more complex and mature inner operating system.
I want to jump quickly into Chapter 11 and then Chapter 6. So Chapter 11, I won't call it religious, but it says spiritual boot camp for leaders. So in order to go up, you have to go deep first. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us about how you get into the head and, you know, what do you do from there, Chapter 11.
Well, there's two basic currents. One is what we call the ascending current, which leadership is boot camp because it calls on the highest in us, spiritual boot camp, our sense of purpose, ethics, values, what matters most, our highest aspirations, and so on, are the pull. So Warren Bennis, when he wrote his book on becoming a leader, said these leaders, they interviewed hundreds of people to tops of their professions. He said these leaders didn't set out to be leaders per se. They set out to follow an urge, and it led them into leadership, an urge they could not be about. So orienting my life and my leadership on that which matters most is the first and primary focus, translating that into vision. And then in order to actually embody that and actually live it out, you meet yourself and your own limitations. And so a lot of the book is about the reactive side of ourselves, which is how we get in our own way. And so we call that the path of descent. How do I descend into that? See the underpinnings of my doubts, fears, needs to control, caution, and so on that can interrupt really effective leadership. And the combination of that is a kind of spiritual boot camp.
Well, and I would add in there, Ed, that we work with a large number of senior leaders, and it's not unusual for us. We've assessed 66,000 leaders across the globe. It's not unusual for us. In fact, it is usual for us to find a leader that has not ever really asked the question, what is it I want? Why am I here? What is it that I uniquely contribute? What's my purpose? And when we start to go into those questions, we ask the deeper questions, the first thing we run up against is ourselves. And we find out that often we get in our own way. So how is it that I can take myself on in a way that my development, my effectiveness increases, I'm able to eliminate those things that get in my way, and then set that kind of model for the people in my organization that work with me and for me. And It is a spiritual journey. There's no question about that, because anytime we look inside like that, it's contemplative. It takes a lot out of us and gives us a lot in order to do that.
So the workforce is changing, not only getting younger, oh my God, but also cross-cultural and gender and international for sure. So chapter 6 is about the metrics, global leadership, cross-cultural, gender application. How are you applying your findings to this new world that we're seeing in the workforce?
Well, we were just in India a week ago, a week before the book launch, which is probably about 2 weeks ago now. So, and we did a pretty thorough study in our database of what does the India culture look like compared to the rest of the world. We see the same pattern in developing countries. So what was really fascinating with it is that what we call the top half, these key creative competencies, are all highly valued and highly correlated to effectiveness as seen by India leaders. The bottom half, reactive, was much more patriarchal than we see around the world, both in terms of how they're showing up as leaders and how they're aspiring, what they're aspiring to. And we had a great conversation with about 200 CEOs throughout the week about where's the point at which this is effective while you're developing, you don't have the educated workforce and so on, talent pool and so on, where control makes more sense and everybody complying makes more sense. When's the tipping point as you bring in the younger generation returning from Harvard, when you are now competing internationally, as the talent pool gets more educated and wanting more engagement and creativity and so on? Really great discussion. So the universal model is a very interesting model to raise these kinds of questions.
Well, and it's, you know, the other one in here too, Ed, as we finish up here, one, have worked in and had the privilege to go into a lot of organizations, a number of high-tech organizations, where the average age is in the mid-20s. And that is a new workforce. The millennials, no different, requiring leadership that is asking more of those that are in leadership and creating an environment that's going to be motivating to them. And their leadership development is really becoming important. We're finding that those young leaders are taking to this, and we have a great deal of interest and passion towards that, and it fits for them. The second thing is that in our model, the universal model that we've been talking about here, women are more effective in general than men in leadership in our measures. In some cases, as much as 15 to 20 percentile more effective, and we have a lot to learn there. They naturally come at it from a more effective place than a lot of men do. So we know that that has implications for us to be able to learn from and take full advantage of what women bring to the workforce. It's a really big study for us. It's really important.
The main finding was that they bring a more relational style. That's now being valued as very highly effective, and especially at a time when we're moving from patriarchy to partnership and trying to build more engaged kind of cultures and organizations. It's a real strength that women are bringing to leadership.
The complexity, relationships become more and more important, and women bring that in a way that men historically have not.
And what about the introduction of internet into the workplace, work day, meaning everybody's on a mobile device, tablet, as well as a laptop, not to mention desktop, but there's so much connectivity and so much open source. How do you see that impacting older people in leadership roles relating to the kids or grandkids?
Like Bob and I, you mean?
Like us?
what we're finding with our clients is that the technology can outpace one's willingness to actually stay up to speed, and it's harder to become, you become less and less relevant if you don't stay with technology and how to fully utilize it, especially in the world today. What I find on the opposite end, and those of us that are older in age in the workforce, that if we become willing, if we get willing to stay up with technology, use it the way it's intended, and bring with it our relational skills that we've learned over the years, it's a great combination. But if we don't stay up with it, we're not as relevant. We can't communicate. Just pure and simple.
From a business perspective, it's one of the most difficult things to manage. it adds tremendous complexity to management, especially if you're a high-tech type company, which we actually are, given the online nature of our business. And so you have to invest in it long before you're clear on your business model and your business model changes. And then technology changes, and you're constantly trying to stay ahead of that curve. It's a huge challenge. And young people come into it with just, they come into it with, this is the reality.
They're digital before they get into the organization.
So what about the issue of silos and communicating and sharing at the more senior levels? Seems to be an ongoing problem.
Well, here's the truism that the farther you go up in the organization, the less feedback you get is still absolutely true. Leaders, especially those that start to surface into higher and higher levels of position or more senior positions, have to consciously make it a practice that they are open and they're soliciting and creating the kind of environment where they're going to get feedback, they're going to get communication in ways that they won't otherwise, because the hierarchy still is in place and will be for many, many years. And the other major element of that, quite frankly, is that we find a lot of our executive senior leaders, and I'll put that as a generalization and own it, are not as good at the basic skills as they need to be. They think because they're in a senior position, they don't have to worry about being effective in conflict, that they don't have to think more about effectiveness in decision-making, how to engage people. And so we find that often our senior executives are less effective at the basic skills than in other places in the organization. Therefore, it impacts everything.
It's a top-down objective to change, but it's still the structure that is in place, and that's
exactly
where the conflict is.
Well, and you can't, if you make the assumption and you believe your own press that because you've been promoted into a senior position, that's synonymous with really, really not needing to go into the basics on the skills and stay on your own edge around your effectiveness, then you're missing the boat. You're going to become less effective instead of more.
Okay, as we come to a close here, I don't want to go through chapter by chapter here, but there's so much here that I'm seeing that I'd love to learn more about chapter 10, for instance, being creative, fulfilling the promise of leadership. What does that mean?
The whole book builds toward a fundamental shift from reactive leaders. Most leaders function at a reactive level of mind and leadership. All the ways we describe effectiveness in leadership today, if you look at all the literature, require a creative level mind. It's a different operating system. And so the book is really about measuring that and the transition into creative mind and how you facilitate that. And it's a much more effective form of leadership. All the ways we define organizations today in terms of what we're moving toward, more innovative, more agile, more engaged, more adaptable, more flexible, so on, require creative leadership. Reactive leadership is not complex enough or mature enough to build that kind of organizational engagement and agility. And so creative leadership is the minimum system requirement.
The very nature of the difference between reactive and creative is on the reactive, we're primarily authored by outside in. In other words, what others think, what's required of us. In the creative side, we're authored from the inside out. In other words, self-authoring. We know what's important to us. We understand our values. We live by those values. We set that in motion. And we all know that when we run into a leader who is very grounded in who they are, what's important to them, and we know where we stand with them, we found a leader that's more effective. That's the basic difference between reactive and creative in the way that I talked about it with my clients and the way we talk about it.
I've got a question now having to do with the recent survey reports by Pew and Gallup about disengagement or being present but not into it. But it's the engagement thing, and is this, number one, is this true, and is it just at the shop level, or is it throughout organizations?
It is true. Engagement levels and the way that we have measured those over the years, we consistently see that the employee workforce from, in many cases, not just the shop level, but all the way up through the leadership ranks, is less engaged now more disaffected, especially in North America, than we've ever been. We've made some gains there. But disengagement for me, or engagement for me, we think about it very simply. Are we getting the full value out of what people have to offer? And if they are disengaged, they're not committed to the work, they aren't getting the type of fulfillment that's required, then we don't get, not only do we not get what they bring, we don't get the discretionary energy. Therefore, the business or the organization's performance is nowhere near what it could be. That comes from leaders that are able to engage people, create outcomes that matter to us, and really draw out that discretionary energy. And that takes a lot of work on your own leadership to be able to do that effectively. It's not the way we're trained in MBA school. We're not trained when we go get our MBA at one of the schools, how it is that we need to engage others and what that requires. And we're going to have to turn that around.
Engagement is really a function of the quality of the leadership of the organization, not only individually. We haven't talked about this as much today, but most of our focus on leadership is individual effectiveness, not collective effectiveness. So how a leadership organization, top one through four levels, have the most impact, how that leadership organization functions together effectively, shows up together in the silo, as you mentioned, and so on, and really effectively leads and engages the rest of the organization, makes all the difference in the culture and the level of engagement.
Yeah, I had a CEO 3 weeks ago in a conversation that said to me that engagement was a vote for or against leadership. Mm-hmm. That the level of engagement in the organization was either a vote for or against leadership. And in this case, that organization was being defined by what they tolerate, not by what they were doing from a leadership perspective collectively to ensure they were creating the environment and the conditions where their people could thrive. And what's important in our work is that we create the conditions and environment where people can thrive. It doesn't mean we don't focus on business results. Those two are synonymous. They go hand in hand. If we're not creating a world of work where people can thrive and engagement's not high, we're not getting what we're paying for, and they're not getting what they're there for. And that's really too bad. Sub-optimization is never a great outcome from my perspective.
The old saying is that people quit their supervisor, they quit their manager, not the company. How do you get the line managers who are further down in the organization but actually are the company to most workers? How do you get those people to have the intelligence and the wanting to grow without any attitude issues to the same extent that the C-level is into your leadership techniques?
Well, if we're talking about first-line supervision and even in the next level or two of leadership, two things. One, significant portion of their jobs is to create the kind of environment and culture where it is that people are going to want to enjoy coming to work, want to put their best in, and helping them understand what it means to create that culture. And then the second element of that is that we have to invest in our leaders once they've been put in positions to help them develop in the ways that are very particular for them. In other words, where am I strong? Where are my deficiencies? Where can I grow and how am I going to do that? That becomes part of what we call a leadership system. In other words, we start at a very early stage of someone's career, develop them in that leadership process, what it means to be a leader both individually and collectively, and then continue to grow it over time. It's development for a lifetime. We're not going to get any better return on our investments than we will directly there. And if we won't do it, then it's done by default. If you don't develop people and you don't create an environment where leaders can grow and develop, then you suffer the consequences of being less effective. And competitively, that's not a great place to be.
I thought I heard an assumption in your question that people at the top are more open to learning and changing and developing than people lower in the organization. I'm not sure that's a valid assumption. I found it a lot of openness to really dig in and lead right down to the shop floor level. So I think it really comes down to whether leaders sponsor change or lead change.
When we find organizations where the leaders think their job is a sponsor, they do that from a distance and they aren't getting their own hands in it and really being part of that conversation and leading it, and the leadership of it is a whole different thing. It means you take active ownership. You know it's as important for you change as it is for everyone else. When you sponsor change, a lot of cases, it's about them, not about us. And too often, our leaders are actually in the position of sponsoring versus leading.
So we've been talking with Robert J. Anderson and William A. Adams, authors of Mastering Leadership. The website is MasteringLeadershipBook.com. Thank you very much, guys, for being our guest today on GlobalRadioTalkShow.com.
Well, thanks so much, Ed. Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Ed Cohen signing off now from San Diego, GlobalRadioTalkShow.com.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful